increasing the well-being of populations.
And Oscar, I wanted to ask you, this summer, the Democratic National Convention will be in Chicago. The eyes of the political world will be on this city. Your sense of what immigrant rights groups around the country are preparing for when that convention comes to Chicago?
Well, I think that the preparation is hardly happening from the perspective of people being too busy trying to deal with the immediate realities of what people often see as a crisis, which I completely disagree it is. But the bottom line is, it's important to understand the reason why Chicago will probably become increasingly important in terms of Republican governors such as Abbott in Texas sending more people into Chicago is precisely because the goal of these people are to create more chaos, to create more divisions, and to use this context of conflict and difficulties as a backdrop to the Democratic Party convention coming up in Chicago. In the end, it is important to highlight people that are motivated by white supremacy, by xenophobia, are basically trying to use migrants as a way of, again, expanding the perception of a crisis and using it electorally to try to minimize the chances of Democrats succeeding in keeping the White House in their hands coming next year.
And finally, Murad, you're in Albany. That's where the New York State governor sits, where the legislature is. Talking about what you feel could be the single most important way in Washington, the Democrats and Republicans, from Biden to Trump before him, can you evaluate what they've done and what they need to do?
Well, on immigration reform and real immigration reform that's going to help people, historic immigrants as well as newcomers, making sure that people have a pathway to legalization, but also making sure that our processes to come into the United States are significantly more equitable, humane, and efficient. That's the piece that we're missing here in this moment. As we're speaking right now, the Senate and President Biden have been negotiating a border deal in exchange for Ukraine military aid, and our community is being held hostage by the most extremist congressional class we've ever had in this moment, where the Biden administration is ready to give up our community's rights to continue to support foreign aid. And if he wants to do that, by all means, do that, but separate these issues from each other. And we're looking at potentially losing immigrant rights in this country, and also the president losing executive order on humanitarian parole and other powers that he can help, as he has done in the past when we have situations like when Afghanistan fell, when Ukrainians were coming into the United States. He uses executive authority to actually provide humanitarian parole. He hasn't done it very expansively as he has in other areas. But what we do know is when you create more legal pathways for people to come into the United States, they use them. And we currently just don't have those systems in place right now. And what, instead of actually being solutions oriented from President Biden down to Congress, they're just looking to have a scapegoat in this moment, as my brother Oscar mentioned. And this is not, our community should not be the issue. They're trying to find a different villain in this story. And they are the villains because they have not addressed the concerns of Americans and all who call the U.S. home for the past couple of decades. And instead of actually resolving the issues people have been facing, they continue to look for other ways to lash out and look for someone to say, this is their it's their fault we are in this place. But it's not. They are the ones empowered. They have the tools and the power to deliver the solutions we all need.
Murad Awaldo, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the New York Immigration Coalition, and Oscar Chacon, Executive Director of Alianza Americas. Next up, the acclaimed Chinese artist Ai Weiwei joins us after his exhibit was canceled in London when he criticized Israel's assault on Gaza. He also has a new graphic novel. Stay with us.
The blues quite quadrupled up, the block is hot. This how they chose to use the guap with this amount of human loss. Could have been for schools or parks, coats in the winter, in the summer, something to cool them off. Food or warmth, cause once the leaves on the tree start falling off, people gon' need heat to keep their ears from falling off. Temperature dropped and back up to the top, from the deepest BK block, back up to the Bronx. What you wanna
hold? Mayor's a Cop by Mike and Wiki. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the acclaimed Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei. In November, he had an exhibit in London canceled after he wrote a social media post where he criticized the United States for its longtime financial support of Israel. Ai Weiwei has previously expressed support for Palestinians. He made a 2016 documentary that includes Gaza in the global refugee crisis called Human Flow. Ai Weiwei is one of the world's most acclaimed artists. In 2011, he was arrested at the Beijing airport, held for 81 days without charge. He's been living in exile since 2015. He's joining us here in New York City ahead of his event tonight at Town Hall. That's part of PEN America's PEN Out Loud series, when he'll discuss his new graphic memoir, Zodiac. Ai Weiwei, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's start with that canceled London exhibit. What happened?
Well, and after I post, a single line on Twitter, you know, I never noticed people really become so sensitive or so crazy about my post. Basically, post that described the situation about Israel's relations with U.S. and which is very. You know, it's very subjective. It's not from my point of view, but it's really a general fact. So then the galleries are actually not one gallery, but galleries in Paris and in London, they get very worried. And I still don't know exact the reason why they have to worry about artists. A single line, you know, but rather they says they want to avoid this kind of argument and trying to protect my interests. So they postponed my shows, not one, but altogether four shows. So I guess that proved what I'm saying on Twitter is correct, because there's all over the world, there's a strong censorship about different voices and towards this kind of conflicts, and the conflicts continues getting so massive and also seems it's not going to stop. So by doing that, many of my shows being canceled, so.
Were you surprised by the reaction, given that you've been not only are you one of the most celebrated artists from China in the West, but also you've been a vocal supporter of the Palestinians for years?
I am surprised. I think we should live in a more free society, and which can allow the different opinions and the voice, but to have this kind of devastating case in dealing with art community, not only art community, but also films or literature. I think it shows a really very bad, backwards in terms of freedom of expression, human rights, and, all those issues.
There are not many Chinese artists as celebrated and embraced by the West as you are, Ai Weiwei. Were you surprised by the swift retaliation against your position, which is really critiquing the West in London, Britain, and the U.S. when it comes to supporting the Israeli government, when it comes to the assault on Gaza?
I think maybe I was celebrated for the wrong reason. But still, as an artist, I have to fight for the human dignity and also basic human rights, freedom of speech, and that's why I'm here. So,
can I ask you about your graphic novel, Ai Weiwei? Talk about Zodiac and the message you're conveying in this graphic memoir.
Well, thanks for asking that. I come to New York to be part of this graphic novel, the promotion. And the novel is take us about 2-3 years with two other person involved. And so we made the drawing and the storyline, and it's very I think it's pretty unique and also charming in telling my personal stories in relate to Chinese classic stories, but also in relating to current event, both in China and in the West. So it's very detailed, very visual narratives about the stories.
Ai Weiwei, your message to the world right now, you are a dissident when it comes to China. You cannot live inside China. You're in exile. And now, when you come and are embraced by the West, you find yourself canceled again and again. Your thoughts?
Well, I think we are living in a very crucial time. Globally, we have to rethink about our values or what we are really defending for. It's not only a challenge for individual artists, but also for the state. And we are gradually losing the ground of democracy or personal freedom, or even we are still in facing a crisis, economic crisis, immigration crisis. Also, we are possibly at the edge of the World War III. You know, this is not an exaggeration. It can happen. And I'm afraid this is the fact. But that would calling for every individual to defend the humanity and the human rights.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Ai Weiwei, world-renowned Chinese artist and activist, has a new graphic memoir called Zodiac. He'll be speaking tonight at Town Hall in New York. Next up, it's primary day in New Hampshire. As Donald Trump and Nikki Haley square off in the Republican race, we'll speak to a Democratic presidential candidate, Marianne Williamson, about her campaign against President Biden. Her name is on today's ballot in New Hampshire, though Biden's is not. Back in 20 seconds.
There's no promise of the future.
Woman by Angel Olsen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Voting's begun in New Hampshire in the nation's first primary. On the Republican side, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley's hoping to pull off an upset over former President Donald Trump, who won last week's caucus in Iowa by a record margin. On the Democratic side, there is a primary today in New Hampshire, but it's received little attention in part because President Joe Biden's name will not be on the ballot. Those supporters are organizing an unofficial write-in campaign. The Democratic National Committee stripped New Hampshire of its delegates after it refused to move its primary until after South Carolina. Historically, Iowa and New Hampshire have held the first contests, giving two of the whitest states in the nation considerable clout in the nominating process. In 2022, the DNC voted to hold the first primary in South Carolina, which has a significant population of color. Iowa agreed to the changes. The Democratic Iowa caucus will take place later. But New Hampshire did not and went ahead anyway with the primary of the Democratic Party as well as the Republicans. Over two dozen other candidates will be on the Democratic ballot in New Hampshire, most prominently Congressmember Dean Phillips of Minnesota and our next guest, Marianne Williamson, a best-selling author, self-described spiritual thought leader who also ran for president in 2020. Williamson has campaigned for a single-payer health care system, cutting the Pentagon's budget, creating a U.S. Department of Peace, and boldly addressing the climate crisis. She's also supported a ceasefire in Gaza. Marianne Williamson is joining us now from Manchester, New Hampshire. Marianne Williamson, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the fact that you are the only person on the Democratic ticket right now of the major Democratic candidates who is supporting a Gaza ceasefire, and then go into your call for a Department of Peace?
The ceasefire, even before the invasion of Gaza by the Israelis, I was on a video saying I thought it was a bad idea. And I have been calling for a ceasefire since the moment it began. You know, obviously there's a big difference between supporting Israel and supporting the Israeli government. There's a big difference between supporting Israel and supporting the policies of Benjamin Netanyahu. And I've been very sorry to see the U.S. government go along with his policy and this war. I think it's a terrible idea. It's terrible for Israel, obviously terrible for the Palestinians, for the region, and I think for the world. In terms of the Department of Peace, you know, Franklin Roosevelt said we need to do more than end wars. We need to end the beginnings of all wars. Just like with health and sickness, you don't just treat sickness. You learn to cultivate health. And we need to not just, you know, drop bombs and put people in prison when there is conflict. We need to learn to prevent conflict. We need to learn to proactively create peace. And there are four main factors involved in what's called peace building. And when these factors are present, statistically, that means there's going to be a higher incidence of peace and a lower incidence of conflict. And this is true whether it's a corner of an American city or another place in the world. And those factors are greater economic opportunities for women, greater educational opportunities for children, a reduction of violence against women, and an amelioration of unnecessary human despair. So just like they play war games, we need to play peace games. Just like we have a military academy, we need to have a peace academy. Just like we have an army of military personnel, we need armies of peace builders. And we need to have that same kind of serious focus and resources placed in creating peace that we now have on fighting wars. This forever war machine that the United States has is a path to disaster in this century.
And Marianne Williamson, can you talk about your decision to run as a Democrat rather than as an independent, given how much you diverge in many of your positions from the, the Democratic Party elite?
Well, that's the point. I don't diverge from the traditional values of the Democratic Party. They do. I'm a Roosevelt Democrat. I believe that the policies of the U.S. government should be used to help people. Now, that Democratic establishment elite that you just referred to, look at someone like myself or any progressive as though we are trying to hijack the party. In fact, they hijacked the party. We're Franklin and Eleanor, and they're the DuPonts and the Whitneys and the Morgans. They're a bunch of economic royalists. You know, that Democratic elite that you're talking about in the Democratic Party, when I was growing up, they would have been called Republicans. So I'm where in my youth and in my growing up and just sort of my perspective, I'm where the center of the Democratic Party should and would have been had it not been for this profound influx of corporate money that has infused both parties.
And you often invoke the idea of traditional values in your speeches. Could you talk a little bit more about what you mean by those traditional values?
Well, I think that there's common sense involved in our trying to be better people. I think no matter whether someone is approaching this from a religious perspective or a secular perspective, we all know that if you try to be a person of integrity, of generosity, of forgiveness, owning your own mistakes, forgiving other people for theirs, your life works better. And I think that those same values and those same considerations, those same reflections on what it means to be good should apply to public policy as much as it applies to our personal behavior. Our public policy is guided by an essentially bankrupt, on a moral level, economic paradigm. There's no sense of ethics. There's no sense of owing anything to anyone. It's all fiduciary responsibility to the stockholder. And that has been going on for 50 years now. And it has devastated this country. It has completely hollowed out our middle class. It has led to a $50 trillion transfer of wealth from the bottom 90% to the top 1%. If all you care about is stockholder value, at the expense of every other stakeholder's interest, at the expense of the workers, at the expense of the community, at the expense of the environment, what happens? What happens is what has happened to this country, where a majority of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. A majority of Americans cannot absorb a $500 unexpected expenditure. And now 39% of Americans claim that they regularly skip meals in order to pay their rent. This is intolerable. It is unacceptable. And we need a president who will say so.
I wanted to talk about you being on the Democratic primary ballot. At a presidential forum you were at that I co-moderated in South Carolina in 2019, I questioned then Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren during that forum at South Carolina State about the primary calendar. Senator Warren, just 30 seconds left. But speaking about racial injustice, do you think the order of the primary state should change? You have Iowa and New Hampshire.
Let me just, before you finish, are you actually going to ask me to sit here and criticize Iowa and New Hampshire?
No, I'm asking about the order.
No, that is what Iowa and New Hampshire
are all
about.
But let me just ask, they're two of the whitest states in the country. And then we move to South Carolina with a very significant population of people of color. And it means the candidates spend so much of their time catering to those first two states. Overall, do you think that should change?
Look, I'm just a player in the game on this one. And I am delighted to be in South Carolina. Thank you.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You, Senator Warren.
Thank you. That was Massachusetts Senator and then presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren. If you could respond to that question, Marianne Williamson. I mean, the reason the DNC, they weren't canceling the New Hampshire primary. They just said Iowa and New Hampshire should come after, later, especially South Carolina, which has a larger community of color. Talk about your decision to be on the New Hampshire ballot.
Well, if the DNC was honestly, authentically, and sincerely coming up from a place of concern about racial diversity, that would be one thing. I don't think that's what happened here, and I don't know anyone in South Carolina who really thinks that's what happened here. What happened here is that Joe Biden came in fourth place or fifth place last time, and they wanted to avoid an embarrassment. Obviously, racial diversity matters, but let me tell you what else matters, and that is economic diversity. And when you want to talk about the actual experience of the average American, the working class Americans in the United States, New Hampshire is as much a ground zero as is any other state. I don't think that any of us should be thinking in terms of playing favorites with the states. And I'm just showing up where there are people. New Hampshire responded to the DNC by saying, no, our state constitution says we're having a primary. And that's just the way it is. And so I'm here because they're having a primary. And I'm taking my cue from the people and not from the DNC.
And Marianne Williamson, I wanted to ask you about your position on the supporting the ceasefire in Gaza. You've supported that since October. Do you think that the failure of the Democratic Party leadership and President Biden to take a clear stand in defense of the Palestinian people is going to result in large numbers of young people, especially, turning away from this election?
I think it's a risk. Unless we nominate someone like myself who's been very clear about all this from the beginning. You know, the president showed great moral clarity on October 7th. but he needs to show the same moral clarity regarding what has happened to the Palestinians. And, yeah, I think young people particularly see a deep injustice there. And, yeah, I think that's a good reason for the Democrats to nominate somebody who represents a stand for not just greater justice for the Palestinians, but for bold American leadership to make sure that we are robustly and equally committed to this peace, safety, security, and sovereignty of both peoples, both Israeli and Palestinian.
Can you talk about the New Hampshire's vote ceasefire campaign? Even though President Biden isn't on the ballot, there is a write-in campaign for him. But there's also a write-in campaign to just say ceasefire. Your thoughts on this, Marianne Williamson?
Well, I believe that if we're really concerned about the citizens of Gaza, if we're most deeply concerned about what action would most get Joe Biden's attention and make him actually reconsider his policies, I think it would be voting for a candidate who actually stands for a ceasefire. I would think that my getting a lot of votes, given the fact that I, in fact, do stand for a ceasefire, would get more of a raised eyebrow from the president than would a write-in campaign for ceasefire. But like in all of these things, the average, not the average, the citizen, the voter, gets to make their decision for themselves. I hope that people who are considering writing in ceasefire from that position, which I know is a sincere desire to help the people of Gaza, I hope they will consider the possibility, which I believe is the reality, that a vote for me would be a stronger statement.
Let me ask you about what happened at Davos. The government corporate elite there seem to say that they think that President Trump is going to win this next election. When the stakes are this high, the two main contenders, Biden versus Trump, of course, always thrown around in the United States for any third party or another Democratic presidential candidate like yourself, is you could be the spoiler in this high-stakes election. Your response to that?
Well, first of all, it's important to remember that this today is a primary. You cannot be a spoiler in a primary. In terms of the general election, I think all of us who are committed to Donald Trump not returning to the White House have a lot to think about there. I would never do anything that I felt would increase the possibility of Donald Trump returning to the presidency.
We have less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about immigration, which has become a major, major issue once again in this presidential race. Your stance on the whole issue of sealing the border and reducing undocumented migration into the country and limiting the number of asylum seekers?
Asylum, to me, is a sacrosanct principle. Obviously, Congress has failed us. Obviously, on the level of the symptom, we simply need greater infrastructure. We need more judges. We need more interviewers. We need more people who can establish credible fear, move people on in the process of integrating into American society if they do meet that standard. Others need to go back to their homes, to their home countries and begin the process legally from there. However, in this issue, as in so many others, my candidacy represents an intention to look at root cause and not just symptom. We need to ask ourselves, why do so many people feel such a desperate need to make their way to the United States from Latin America particularly? And if we look at that, we see America's fingerprints in far too many ways. I want to help the American people wisely and compassionately look in the mirror. If you look at the ways that our own foreign policy over the last 40, 50, 60 years have contributed to the economic destabilization of so many of these countries, I want to see the United States help restabilize what we in too many ways help destabilize. That will include removing the sanctions on Venezuela, removing the sanctions on Cuba, removing Cuba from the terrorist list, obviously, as well.
That,
we should be giving far more aid. Thank you.
Marianne Williamson, 2024 Democratic presidential candidate on the ballot in New Hampshire. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.